On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It was a wild year in book publishing. The fake memoir scandal, the OJ scandal, the plagiarism charges when Opal Mehta got kissed. But it was some year for reading, too. Nonfiction on war and Iraq that made you want to go to the streets or get under the covers and hide. Fiction on life and love and small wonders that made you want to get under the same covers and read all night. Pynchon was back. Cormac McCarthy went post-nuclear. Lynn Cox swam with a whale. Alice McDermott stayed Irish Catholic. Richard Ford took the lay of the land. Irene Nemirovsky spoke from the grave in Sweet Francaise. Up next on Point, we'll look at the best books and big books of 2006. Joining me this hour are two voracious readers, to say the least. From New York, Charlotte Abbott's here. She's senior editor at Publishers Weekly, the influential publishing industry trade magazine, which reviews books a month or two before they come out. Charlotte Abbott, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And with us from San Francisco is Oscar Villalón. He is book editor at the San Francisco Chronicle. Mr. Villalón, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
So we'll get into the particular picks and can't wait to hear them. We'll have readings and hear from writers as well in this hour. But Charlotte Abbott, step back with us for a second. Going to sort of give us your take on this year in books. What was the big news out there?
Well, the good news was that it was a really rich fall for fiction. There were almost so many books out there that not all of them got the attention that they deserved. So from the reader's point of view, there's an embarrassment of riches. Literary authors like Charles Frazier, the author of Cold Mountain, this is going into the fall. This is what booksellers were looking for, authors like Charles Frazier, Alice McDermott, Richard Ford. You mentioned a number in your intro.
Right.
And, you know, people were also looking forward to, a new book from Michael Crichton, Mitch Albom, Stephen King, Carl Hiaasen. And then there were these drop-in titles, meaning books that came into the season late that were big surprises, like Thomas Pynchon. Mm-hmm. There was a nonfiction book from John Grisham about a man who was unjustly on death row. So there were just tons of books coming into the system. Not all of them got the attention they deserved.
Oscar Villalón, we started out the year with a lot of scandal. There was the whole kerfuffle over fake memoirs, and then, of course, the OJ book that was and wasn't that got pulled, plagiarism charges. It was kind of rocky before the big book started coming and all the excitement came.
That's true. I think we pretty much set the table for the fall. The interesting thing about all the scandals were, particularly the one with the memoirs and James Frey, and I guess there was one brewing now with Augustin Burroughs after Buzz Biesinger's article in Vanity Fair about Running with Scissors. I guess it became kind of clear that people aren't clear on what a memoir is. Apparently, publishers thought that a memoir is kind of like fiction. And readers thought that, well, memoirs are supposed to be true. So it's kind of
the dictionary definition.
That
is
the dictionary. That's the last time we checked.
Right.
But nonetheless, it's good that we cleared that up with the help of Oprah, and now everyone seems to be on the same page. And likewise, not too long ago, along those lines, we had the OJ's non-confessional confessional.
Mm-hmm.
Which is very intriguing because of who that scandal, who it befell to. Judith Regan, who pretty much was, the golden child of publishing in terms of finding books that were hugely popular in terms of sales. Such great titles as, I think, Jenna Jameson's memoir.
Well, sure,
we think it's a memoir.
Right.
I think somewhere along the line, I think she was the first one to publish the Howard Stern, his stuff.
Yeah.
All the classics. But anyway, we found out apparently there's a red line as far as what even people like Rupert Murdoch are willing to tolerate. And I guess a non-confessional confessional is not one of them.
Believe it or not, Charlotte, the Iraq War brought out just an incredible parade of nonfiction. Cobra 2, An Imperial Life in the Emerald City, Rory Stewart writing about Iraq and Afghanistan. We had him on and heard from Fiasco, my old friend Tom Ricks, Bob Woodward's State of Denial. This was a very rich and popular vein this year. People struggling, eager, hungry to figure out what in the heck is going on in this world.
It's true. And I think, we've seen this in the last couple of years that books are really kind of the go-to source for this information. People feel like they're not getting the full story on the news. The Bush administration, rather infamously, has shut out reporters and cast a kind of very suspicious eye on the media. And I think readers feel like they need to go to people who were there on the ground who can tell a story at book length and really kind of give them the details, like Rory Stewart, for example.
And writers.
And so in a funny way, it's been the triumph of the book form in this age of other media.
Yeah, writers and reporters responding in abundance to that hunger. Of course, it's fiction that gets most people really wrapped up and engrossed on these cold winter nights. Oscar Villalón, begin to take us into your list of favorites here. What's at the top of the Villalón reading lineup?
Okay, well, at the very, very top, and that's probably two varies too much, is Cormac McCarthy's The Road. I should point out that the San Francisco Chronicle, our book reviews, best of the books of the year list will be coming out this Sunday.
Yeah.
And we list five in fiction and five in nonfiction. And the fiction are Cormac McCarthy's The Road, which I think probably is the best book of the year. Richard Ford's The Lay of the Land.
Mm-hmm.
I thought Philip Roth's Everyman. Edward P. Jones' story collection, All Aunt Hagar's Children, and Kate Atkinson's newest crime novel, and I use that term. Actually, that's probably not the right term. It should be probably just a novel in which crimes happen.
This is the story sparked off Edinburgh Road Rage, and off we go.
Oh, yes. One good turn. You know, she is such a... I got to tell you, given that the list of that five, you may say, well, what's Kate Atkinson doing there? Not because she isn't a fine writer. She's a very, very good writer, and if anybody, as some people should know, if they don't know already about her, she won a Whitbread Award and started off her career pretty much as a literature type writer, and then started writing these sort of crime novels in which I think she's really found a forum for her talents to run wild. The main talent being she's got a unique, entertaining, witty, very funny, authorial voice.
Yeah, it's a beauty. But take us back to your very tip-top choice there, Cormac McCarthy's The Road. Describe that for us, and I think you've got a little reading you might do for us, Oscar Villalón.
I do. Well, in fact, essentially, it's a, how to describe it? A post-apocalyptic fable, I guess would probably be the best way to describe
it. A father and son in a post-nuclear world on a kind of endless trudge. Well, you tell us.
Well, we assume it's post-nuclear. We don't know. All we know is that something very, very bad happened. And now the world is essentially a giant ball of ash. And it's a father and son somewhere in America trying to make their way down to the ocean, trying to survive in scavenging. Let me read you a paragraph.
Great.
From The Road. This will give you a sense of not only the sort of, I guess, bleakness to the novel, but the beauty behind that.
Mm.
They scrabble through the charred ruins of houses they would not have entered before. A corpse floating in the black water of a basement among the trash and rusting ductwork. He stood in a living room, partly burned and open to the sky. The water-buckled board sloping away into the yard, soggy volumes in a bookcase. He took one down and opened it and then put it back. Everything damp, rotting. In a drawer he found a candle, no way to light it. He put it in his pocket. He walked out in the gray light and stood, and he saw for a brief moment the absolute truth of the world. The cold, relentless circling of the interstate earth. Darkness implacable. The blind dogs of the sun in the running. The crushing black vacuum of the universe. And somewhere, two hunted animals, trembling like ground foxes in their cover. Borrowed time and borrowed world and borrowed eyes with which to sorrow it.
Mm. Cormac McCarthy's The Road. Charlotte Abbott, you've got there a revolver with just two bullets left. Cannibal thugs on the highway. And as published as Weekly put it, haunting and grim novel about civilization's slow death after the power goes out. Speaking to our fears these days.
That is true. I have to say, my list is perhaps not as dark.
Give us some of the top of yours there, Charlotte.
The book that I probably loved the most and that I will give to the most people at Christmas is Lynn Cox's Grayson, which is in many ways an antidote to The Road. She is a long-distance swimmer. And this is a story from when she was 17, and she was starting to train on these long swims in the morning in the ocean off the coast of California. And she was on a 45-minute workout when she discovered all these strange phenomena were happening around her. These fish were behaving strangely. There were weird sort of surges and just strangeness. But she kept with it because she was, you know, training for her distance swimming. And yeah. She figured out that it was a baby whale following her, and that through sort of talking with a fisherman who was observing the larger situation, realized that it had lost its mother.
Now, I haven't read it. I've seen it. It's a slim book, just 100 pages. Is this one of these kind of inspirational stories drawn from, you know, a strange experience in life?
I guess I would dare to say that it could be the Jonathan Livingston Seagull of our time, because she swims with this whale for maybe 4 hours. She decides to stay with it to help it find its mother. She is crazy enough to believe that she can make a difference, and they manage to communicate. So it's a fascinating story, not only from the point of view of, you know, what is this girl doing a mile out from the shore, more than a mile out, going toward this oil rig to the deep water where the whale can actually send a message, you know, kind of beam its radar signals deeper and farther and as it calls for its mother. But then she's out there and the swells are getting higher and she has to get back to shore, and the whale helps her do that. She's been there with this whale for him when he, you know, as he was calling to his mother in the deep water. Now she needs to get back to shore. And she knows she needs him to help her do it. And at that very moment, Grayson swam right up to me within an inch, and he let me touch him. His skin felt rubbery, like a mushroom, and not at all slimy. It gave a little when I touched it. I reached on top and felt his dimples, and then I slid my hand under him and smiled. I held the baby whale in my hand, and I felt the life within him, much the same as I had when I held a tiny grunion. But Grayson's life force was so much bigger. He trusted me enough to let me touch him. We were from two different worlds, two different beings, with two different lives, and yet somehow we understood each other.
Wow, and there we are in the sea with Grayson, swimming along with that great whale. Charlotte, Oscar, lots of listeners want to join us. I want to begin to turn to them. Let me go to DeWitt, Michigan, and Jill. Hi, Jill, you're on the air.
Hi, greetings from the Brzee family tree.
Is my cousin Jill?
Your cousin Jill Foley.
Wow, what are you? I'm great. It's great to hear your voice, Jill. What are you reading?
Well, my favorite book this year, hands down, was Irene Nemirovsky's Sweet Francais.
Oh, yes.
It was just...
Bravo!
The story of that book is just incredible, and I left it wanting more, and to know that you can't have more is just... It just leaves you feeling empty and sad.
I've heard a lot of people say that, including my French father-in-law, who was sort of there. This is the Irene Nemirovsky who wrote about life in Paris, in France, in defeat. She died at Auschwitz in 1942, left this behind.
She was Jewish, and she got, you know, she lived in France not as being a citizen, and so she got caught up in it. But she was writing it as it happened, and so you get the first two stories of what she had hoped to be a five-part suite.
Cousin Jill, what was it about this one that got its teeth into you?
I think it's the fact that her children were hidden for the rest part of the war, and the 12-year-old daughter or 10-year-old daughter had the foresight to carry off this manuscript, didn't know it was a manuscript, just thought it was a diary, and 60 years later finally opened it and found this completed work. It's just an amazing story.
Charlotte, I heard you bravoing there. Were you taken away with Sweet Francais?
I did. I mean, it was just an incredibly vivid story. I think your sort of cousin captured that sense of, you know, as people are fleeing Paris just hours ahead of the Germans, you know, you're right there with every grain of grit under your fingernails. And it's a powerful, overwhelming story. And then that she died in Auschwitz is just it's really a sad, sad loss. And it's a book that sold very well throughout the year. You know, clearly word of mouth was building. A lot of readers are talking about it. And I think that in paperback, it is just going to blow out.
Wow.
Yeah,
wow.
I would say it was definitely, I think you would agree probably with this, Charlotte. It was a surprise hit. I don't think anybody thought it was going to do as well as it did.
Well, it's
which
hard
is probably,
when you have a dead author.
Well, a dead author from World War II, nonetheless. Also, in case if listeners are interested, Stanford University Press recently published a biography of Irene Nemirovsky. It's a slim biography, but it's pretty interesting. It turns out she's quite a complicated character.
Yeah, and some book, by all accounts. Jill, it's great to hear from you. Thanks so much for
calling
in. Best to the family.
Thank you.
Oscar, speaking of complicated characters and insight, you know, I know near the top of your list on the nonfiction side were the Paris Review interviews. What swept you away there?
Everything. You know, whenever you can get in one volume, and I should at this point say, I think the Paris Review is going to publish several volumes of this.
This is edited by Philip Gurevich. And who were they interviewing? From what period?
Well, let's see. Everything from Dorothy Parker to Joan Didion. Everything in between that. I mean, the first volume has interviews with Parker, Truman Capote, T.S. Eliot, Saul Bellow, Rebecca West, Elizabeth Bishop, Robert Stone. And one of my favorites is the interview they do with Jorge Luis Borges down in Buenos Aires. That's it's an awesome interview because Borges, believe it or not, is a very funny man. And this comes out clearly in the interview, an interview which takes place, I believe, at his office at his as the head librarian down in Argentina, in Buenos Aires, I should say. And, of course, by this point, he's lost most of his eyesight. Mm. And throughout the interview, his secretary keeps interrupting him in the interviewer, saying the Campbells are here, and he keeps dismissing them, saying, yes, yes, okay, the Campbells, yes, 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 the Campbells. It's wonderful. I mean, for one thing, you get to hear these iconic writers talk about their craft, and they talk about it in a very no-nonsense way. I think it's kind of amusing that everybody in this volume, except for Robert Stone, doesn't care for creative writing programs. that's very interesting.
Yep.
And also, you know, they're very practical about what they do. They understand that they're not too enraptured with the act of writing. That's work. What's more important are the ideas you pour into your writing. That's what makes it substantial.
Can you give us a little bit of the Borges interview, just a taste there of what that sounds like?
I can indeed. And this is something that just kind of knocked me for a loop. In the middle of the interview, for some reason, they start talking about knife fights. And apparently Borges knows a lot of stuff about knife fighting. Okay. He knows a lot of stuff about everything. But here's an excerpt. He says, "I remember that a brave man, when I was a young man in the slums, he was always supposed to carry a short dagger, and it was worn here, like this." And at this point, he points to his armpit. "So it could be taken out at a moment's notice, and the slum word for the knife, or one of the slum words, well, one was el fierro, but of course that means nothing special. But one of the names that has been quite lost, it's a pity, was el vaiven, the come and go. In the word come and go," and here Borges makes a gesture, "you had the flash of the knife, the sudden flash." Now, this is, you know,
when do you get the chance to hear that? And there it is. Wonderful, wonderful. I love
exactly.
It.
And there's surprises like that throughout the entire collection.
The Paris Interviews, Volume 1 right there. Let's hear from our listeners. Larry's calling from El Cater, Iowa. Hi, Larry. You're on the air. Larry, are you there, my friend? Let me turn to another calling from Dedham, Massachusetts. We've got Sam on the line. Hi, Sam. Are you there, my friend?
I am. Hello?
Yes. What are you reading, Sam? What'd you love?
I read a wonderful book on Iraq called Babylon by Bus by two young men who developed the Yankee Suck T-shirt here in Boston. And it was a look at the situation from a non-reporter's point of view, and it was just a fabulous image of it.
What did you learn from Babylon by Bus and two Bohemians in Baghdad that you did not learn from, I don't know, the newspapers or from us, Sam?
Well, you don't get the feeling from the newspapers that these are real people. You get much more of a feeling of that these are fellow human beings over there that somehow just doesn't come through in the papers.
There you go. A gem recommended by Sam, Babylon by Bus. Let me bring another voice in, the voice of writer, novelist, essayist, and literary critic Francine Prose joins us now. Francine, thanks very much for being back with us on Point.
Oh, sure. It's a pleasure.
Tell us what you loved this year, Francine.
Well, you know, as always, I'm just kind of a sucker for good writing. So the books that I love the best were the books that just seemed to me the most beautifully written books of the year. So my candidate for the fiction book, I'm going to have, actually I have many candidates in all categories, so I really had to kind of narrow this down. But my candidate for the fiction book that I liked the best was Deborah Eisenberg's story collection, Twilight of the Superheroes.
So we've got short stories there. You're out with your own this year, Reading Like a Writer. So we know you're reading closely. Give us a sense of what Deborah Eisenberg delivers there in Twilight of the Superheroes.
Well, I'll read a passage. This is, I mean, you know, people have been talking, especially this year and a little bit last year, of the kind of new post 9/11 books and writers, fiction writers, trying to give a sense of what it's like in this changed world. And the title story is about New York and the immediate aftermath of 9/11, and I think it's the most beautiful and the most accurate description of what it felt like to be here.
Ooh, let's hear it.
So this is a passage. In restaurants and cafes all over the city, people seem to have changed. The good-hearted, casually wasteful festival was over. In some places, the diners were sullen and dogged, as if they felt accused of getting away with something. In other places, the gaiety was cranked up to the level of completely unconvincing hysteria. For a long, miserable while, in fact, the city looked like a school play about war profiteering. The bars were overflowing with very young people from heaven only knew where, in hideous, ludicrously showy clothing, spending massive amounts of money on green, pink, and orange cocktails, and laughing at the top of their lungs as if at filthy jokes. No, not like a school play, like a movie, though the performances and the direction were crude. The loud, ostensibly carefree young people appeared to be extras recruited from the suburbs, and yet sometime in the distant future, people seeing such a movie might think, oh, yes, that was a New York that existed once, say, at the end of the millennium.
Mm. Everything pumped up just a little too high, and it feels creepy. Oscar Villalone, did you read Deborah Eisenberg's Twilight of the Superheroes?
Yeah, it's very, very good. I mean, she's always been good, I think, as Francine Prose would tell you. You know, and putting together my best of list, there's so many things that you got to leave out. I mean, at some point, the list becomes so subjective in terms of what you think is best. I mean, I like that collection a lot, but I even like more was Edward P. Jones' story collection, All and Hagar's Children.
Many set in Washington, D.C. They're short stories again.
Short stories, but, it's simplistic to say that the thing that makes it really interesting is he's writing about Black America and he's writing about Washington, D.C., but his artistry really is breathtaking. In fact, the title story, it's kind of fun. It's sort of like a detective story. It's kind of a riff, I think, off of Walter Mosley's writing, just to give you an idea of what's in there. But, you know, the way he writes about relationships and death the difficulty of everyday living, I found to be very, very impressive.
Many people noting that one from Edward Jones. Let me get a call from Westport, Connecticut. And Doug, hi, Doug. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
We're good. What are you reading, Doug? What do you love?
Well, my favorite book this year was Special Topics in Calamity Physics by Marisha Pessel. And I'm not in the book business, so I kind of missed the pre-publication hype, about which I've read a lot since then. But I had my 15-year-old, going into 10th grade daughter read it this summer, and she loved it. And it's full of all sorts of remarkably rich descriptions and turns of phrases that you wouldn't expect, but which are very perfectly described.
I give it credit for maybe the best title of the year, Special Topics in Calamity Physics. You have to look twice at that. Give us the story in a nutshell, Doug.
That's a bit of a toughie because it's a little bit of a cipher, but it's the story of a precocious teenager in a prep school and whose father has moved all around the country. And on the page one, she describes that it's the book is a murder mystery of a teacher that inspired her at this very school.
And students with the charismatic teacher, secrets aplenty, and a great title. Doug, thanks for that call. Charlotte Abbott, how about Marisha Pessel's specialty topics in Calamity Physics?
It was definitely one of the kind of surprise success stories in a year where it was just hard for books to kind of get traction. I mean, there just weren't a lot of books kind of popping out and really taking off in the first part of the year. And that book just, it kind of hit the New York Times Book Review, and and a lot of critics just the right way at the right time, kind of at the beginning of, or I guess it was in the, more toward the middle of the summer, and it did get some traction as a summer reading pick.
Francine Prose, you've got another a book that reaches back. Jennifer Egan's The Keep reaches back to childhood, but brings it very much up to date. Kind of a creepy novel. Tell us about The Keep.
Well, it's an updated gothic thriller. It has all the elements. I mean, it's as if a kind of genius wrote a Stephen King novel, and it has sort of 19th century gothic elements, and it keeps changing. I mean, it has, you know, it's a real, as they say, page turner, and yet it's so daring and so original and so strange. I mean, you know, just as sort of speaking of reading like a writer, I mean, the way a writer reads, I was reading it and I kept thinking, God, I can't believe she can get away with this. I can't believe that she knew she could do this and did it so beautifully.
Well, Francine Prose, author of A Changed Man, Blue Angel, Reading Like a Writer. Great to hear your picks for 06. Thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Let me go to Larry now in Elkader, Iowa. Hi, Larry. You're on the air. We've got you, I hope.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
E.O. Wilson, the noted ecologist, has done a Bring Us Together book. The title is The Creation, An Appeal to Save Life on Earth. Wilson, who's a secular humanist, has written a letter to a hypothetical evangelical pastor saying, you know, we don't care about religion. We do care about life on Earth, no matter how it got here, and let's work together to solve our environmental problems, especially global warming, and bring us together in that way.
Did it look like E.O. Wilson was charting out some common ground to you, Larry?
Indeed. That was his attempt. It'll be interesting to see how successful he is in that attempt, but I think it's a worthwhile exercise at the very least.
There we go. E.O. Wilson's a big one this year. Larry, thanks very much for calling in. Oscar, what else have you got looking down there? Describe a little more of what you love to us.
All right. Well, actually, let me pick up where we left off with E.O. Wilson's book, The Creationist, because two of the other books that I thought were excellent this year, nonfiction, were Richard Dawkins' The God Delusion and Daniel Dennett's book, Breaking the Spell, Religion as a Natural Phenomenon. Mm-hmm. And I think they can be grouped with E.O. Wilson's book, because essentially what they're all trying to tackle is the thorny problem of where do we put religion in terms of its importance in public life. And you have E.O. Wilson, who's very accommodating. Then you have on the opposite end of that spectrum Dawkins, who of course has
militant atheist.
Well, yes, he has no. But I should say that he's caustic, but he's also very extremely witty, and he's a very good writer, and he's a strenuous, elegant thinker.
We're talking this hour about the best books of 2006. Pynchon's out there, and Ford and McCarthy, McDermott, Baruma, Ricks, and a whole lot more. Oscar Villalone from the San Francisco Chronicle is with us, and Charlotte Abbott, senior editor at Publishers Weekly. Right now, we're joined as well by David Nassau. He's a professor of history at the City University of New York Graduate Center, author of the book The Chief, The Life of William Randolph Hearst, and this year the widely acclaimed biography Andrew Carnegie, a New York Times 100 Notable Books of the Year selection. David Nassau, thanks a lot for joining us.
Delighted to be here.
So lots of people enjoying your book on Carnegie. There you are. Congratulations. What have you been reading beyond writing?
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
You know, to pick up a theme that we've been, that I've been hearing you all talk about, religion. I read a wonderful little book called Moral Minority, or Skeptical Founding Fathers by Brooke Allen, which makes the case by looking back at the writings and behavior of the Founding Fathers that they had no intention of making this a Christian nation, that they were men of the Enlightenment, that they were skeptics, they were men of science, and they intentionally made sure that this was a secular republic, not a Christian republic.
So the call of the deists there from the founding of the republic?
Exactly. That the men who founded the republic called themselves deists, and when they called themselves deists, they distinguished that from being Christians. They believed, they thought that it was possible there was a supreme being somewhere but he or she did not exercise control over everything that happened here on Earth.
You've also got one, The Woman in Jerusalem.
Yeah, I thought this was a remarkable book. It's by A.B. Yehoshua, the Israeli writer.
Tell us the story.
It's a very strange story. A woman is killed in a suicide bombing. And the only
In Jerusalem.
In Jerusalem, right. Mm-hmm. And the only identification on her body is a pay stub from a bakery. No one picks up the body. No one identifies her. A tabloid journalist writes a big story about the shocking, quote, the shocking inhumanity behind our daily bread, and says, how could the bakery which employed her not have known that she was missing? A man in the human relations department at the human resources division, at the bakery is instructed to find out who she was and how she could have met such a terrible death without anyone of her fellow workers noticing. And he sets in motion this investigation, which brings him to the outer reaches of a former Soviet republic. It is a remarkable book. It has strains. It's almost Kafkaesque in the prose. None of the characters have names, and yet their humanity is put front and center on every page.
And then I see one more here from E.L. Doctorow. He was out with The March last year, Sherman's March to the Sea Reimagined, this time out with a book of essays, and it makes your short list.
I love this book. I adore Doctorow's writing. He is a writer's writer. And in this book,
Creationists, Selected Essays, 93 to 06. Yep.
Yes. In very much like the Paris Review interviews that Oscar was talking about, this is a book by a writer about other writers, and it takes us inside the craft in a remarkable way. Doctorow imagines what Melville went through in writing Moby Dick, and opens up the book after 150 years in exciting new ways. And then he talks about other creators. One of my favorite little chapters in here is about Harpo Marx. if I could just read a passage.
Sure.
This is from the Harpo chapter of E.L. Doctorow's The Creationists. The world young Harpo had to outwit included not only cops, truant officers, and neighborhood toughs, but also his family's impoverishment and a degree of distraction from his loving parents that allowed him to drop out of school in the second grade. He had to outwit the New York of his day that gave to such children of immigrants as Adolfo Harpo Marx a tenement air shaft in which to hang his Christmas stocking, and the luxury of attending New York Giants baseball games on a hill outside the ballpark from which he could see only the left fielder. Wonderful.
E.L. Doctorow's Creationist. Let me get a call from Montreal, Canada. Anthony is calling. Hi, Anthony. You're on the air.
Good day. The most remarkable book I've read this year is Left to Tell. It's a memoir of the Rwandan Holocaust.
Left to Tell, written by a survivor?
Written by a survivor of the Rwandan Holocaust. For its message and for its forgiveness, I would compare it to Dr. Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning.
I haven't read it and don't know Left to Tell, but here we are a decade after that genocide, and you still find this one moving, Anthony.
Yes, very much so, because, the writer is, I hope I can say her surname properly. The writer is Immaculée Ilbagiza.
Ilbagiza. Mm-hmm.
Ilbagiza. Mm-hmm. And Dr. Wayne Dyer has been very helpful to her. And Immaculée was recently interviewed on 60 Minutes.
So there's a thumbs up for Left to Tell. It was still drawing meaning and a kind of inspiration from events in Rwanda. Let me get another call from Savannah, Georgia. Fred's on the line. Hi, Fred. You're on the air.
Yes, I just read An Innocent Man by John Grisham. You had mentioned it a little earlier in the broadcast.
Yeah.
And it's just ironic. There's a here in Savannah, there's a murder case in the courts right now involving a debutante, Miss Ross, and all the evidence against the accused. I'm not on the jury. I'm just reading about it in the paper.
Yeah.
All the evidence against the accused is verbal. There's no forensic evidence whatsoever. And there's a lot of evidence coming out of prison inmates under duress being offered this, that, and the other thing by in order to testify. And it's like a mirror image of this of the story of an innocent man.
So echoes.
I don't know that these people are innocent.
Yeah.
there's no way you can tell. But it's shocking. I'm reading it in the paper and going, oh my gosh, I just read this story, except it was in Oklahoma. And in this case, there's also a racial element. But
right.
It's fascinating.
And echoes right there in your courts in Savannah. Fred, thanks for that. Charlotte Abbott, When John Grisham Stands Up, the publishing world heads all turn, fiction or nonfiction, I guess.
That is for sure. And what's interesting is that he hasn't delivered a novel for the last couple of years. So there was a lot of sort of excitement and anticipation for this book, which was his first book of nonfiction.
Mm. And Oscar Villon, how about we've got David Nassau here with his own Andrew Carnegie out. Lots of attention for this biography, Turning Heads itself.
Oh, yeah. No, no, absolutely. You know, I think books, particularly about people like the Carnegie, and then of course before that, Nassau's book on my boss, or Once Upon a Time, My
right,
Boss.
Right.
You know, we're fascinated, I think, by these sort of robber barons. You know, and I think today with Enron and this sort of thing, and then of course with all the newfound wealth from the .coms or the ones that did well, you know, the Googles and the Yahoos.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's these books are fascinating because we kind of want to know, well, you know, what lies in wait? Will there be these sort of, you know, benevolent people coming from that? Will there one day, will someone, you know, from Google, you know, endow Google University down somewhere in the peninsula, the Bay
right.
Area?
The Google you Foundation. David Nassau, how about it? You've got another robber baron here after William Randolph Hearst, the one-time boss of the world of Oscar Villon. What have you made of the public response to your description of this Gilded Age guy now?
I've been, you know, just astounded. I think I was very lucky because just, you know, 3 months before my book came out, Warren Buffett decided to give away $31 billion.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So philanthropy was in the air. The rich were in the air. And there is no one, I don't think, as fascinating, at least, you know, from my perspective, as Andrew Carnegie, a man who spent half his life making the world's greatest fortune and the next half trying to give it all away, and whose greatest defeat in life was his inability to give away all his money because of compound interest. The more he gave away,
what a problem.
The more he kept earning. Yeah.
Oh, boy.
Most of us.
I have the same problem.
Yeah, me too. The rubber baron's lament. It's a big one.
Yeah.
David Nassau, it's been wonderful to have you with us for a few minutes here. Thanks for Andrew Carnegie, the book this year, and thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Let me take a call from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Mark is on the line. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Hi, guys. Hi. Great to hear people talking avidly about books for a change.
And, yes.
I'm an avid reader myself, and the book that has got me is a book by Mark Haddon, H-A-D-D-O-N.
Okay.
His second work, his first, your guests may be familiar with The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime. Does that ring a bell? Any of the guests?
Sure.
Well, he came out with it's a really unique book written from the point of view of an autistic teenager. And so that,
what's it called, Mark? What's it called?
The second book that I'm talking about is called A Spot of Bother by Mark Haddon.
And is this for young adults or an adult read?
The first one is a young adult, but I recommend it for adults, anybody. It's one of those. The second one is definitely an adult read, and I picked it up with some trepidation thinking, okay, how can it compare to the first? And it's just as great. It's just as funny, real unique style. He writes from each point of view from the point of view of each one of the characters, and I'm just really sold on it.
What did you learn about the autistic mind or feel that you learned, Mark, from getting that point of view?
Well, from the first book, The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime, I learned that we're not all so different than many of the points that this autistic child was saying. And One thing, for example, he's not able to lie, and it just brings home the truth that we all are telling like slight untruths and kind of lying to ourselves a lot. And that's what I liked, is it things that you could totally relate to. And he can't take big crowds, so he kind of freaks out when he's in a crowd or in the subway. And I think we've all been there, basically. And
we'll write it down. A Spot of Bother by Mark Haddon. And Mark, thank you for calling us. Let's get a call from Watertown, New York, and Jennifer. Hi, Jennifer. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
How are you?
We're good. What have you loved in between covers this year?
I love the book Severance.
Severance. This is Robert Olin Butler's?
Bolter? Robert Olin Butler's Severance. I heard him interviewed on, I think it was All Things Considered, and so I picked the book up, and I just couldn't put it down, and that doesn't usually happen because I don't have a lot of time because I stay home with 5 kids.
Tell us about it.
It's a book about the severed heads from people who have been decapitated, and the theory is that the head stays alive for a minute and a half after it's been severed from the body, and in a heightened state of an emotion, speaks at 160 words per minute. So each story is 240 words.
And is this of historical figures who were actually beheaded, Jennifer?
Some of them are historical, and I think that they're all historical, but some of them are famous and some of them are not famous.
Wow. No end to where books can take us, to the last minute and a half of the thought of the mind detached from body. Wow, something else. Jennifer, thanks for that. Let me go to Cedar Rapids, Iowa, and Laura. Hi, Laura. What have you read and loved?
Good morning.
Hey.
I fell in love with a book that was very surprising to me. I've read lots of wonderful books this year, but the book that I fell in love with was Death of a Musketeer by Sarah Dalmeida.
And is it The Three Musketeers Come Back Again or something else?
It is a Dumas pastiche, but it is it's almost a cross between the 17th century of Dumas and the real 17th century. It's a murder mystery, and the people who solve it are D'Artagnan and his three musketeer friends. But unlike in the Dumas book, where Porthos is actually stupid, in this book, Porthos is inarticulate, but definitely a man of deeds rather than of words. Somebody who's got the intelligence of the body. And it was an amazingly fun read for anybody who's ever read Dumas.
Well, how terrific. We've got severed heads and the intelligence of the body going back to back there. Death of a Musketeer. Laura, thanks for calling from Cedar Rapids. Charlotte, final thoughts, titles you want to get out there that we haven't named yet that you really want
to
hold up in 06?
There is one. We haven't talked about any graphic novels. And I really loved Alison Bechtel's Fun Home. Fun Home refers to, it's sort of an ironic commentary on the house she grew up on. Her father was a funeral director, so it also refers to the funeral home and the funeral business.
Lots of fun.
He was a closeted gay man who sort of fancied himself a 19th century aristocrat and kind of tried to create this, what she calls a still life with children in this Victorian house in Pennsylvania, where he's kind of living this increasingly sort of ossified fantasy in which he is not gay, except he is, and he's, you know, having trouble suppressing it, and his wife kind of turns into this husk of a woman. And meanwhile, his daughter, Alison Bechtel, who's telling the story in pictures, is a young woman who blossoms into her sexuality in her sort of late teen years and finds that she's gay. So it's very poignant. I mean, it speaks to anyone who has lived in a family with secrets, and it's all in these incredible images. The story is told very graphically, very vividly. She actually went back to her childhood home. She took pictures of herself in that space and configured herself as she wanted the frames to appear. So she based on sort of actual photos. I mean, this is a total antidote to James Frye. This is going right back and researching your life in the most minute detail. And it just makes for an incredibly powerful reading experience.
The Truth in Images, graphic novel there, Fun Home. I guess that's all we're going to get to, but the list go on and on. A rich year by year's end. Oscar Villalón, excited about the year to come. Do you see big things coming down the pike?
I do indeed. Let's see. We got, what, novels coming out from...
Harry Potter!
Harry Potter. We got Norman Mailer, Paul Auster.
Norman Mailer.
Michael Ondaatje.
That's right. We also have a new novel from Daniel Alarcón. He's going to be somebody special.
So a lot more popping out there. I hope we can come back and talk about them with you. Oscar Villalón at the San Francisco Chronicle. Great to have you today. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome.
And Charlotte Abbott at Publishers Weekly. Charlotte, thanks for being with us again.
It was really fun.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.